Well, it's great to see all of you again. I saw many of you up at the Wisconsin Dells, and I'm sure you would agree it was a wonderful feast. How many here were not at the Wisconsin Dells for the Feast of Tabernacles? Good, so I don't need to tell you anything about it. You all get it. It's been my 30th feast, and I don't know how many I've kept at the Dells. I don't know, at least half of those. And for all those years, I think it was the most peaceful. And as Mr. Morrison was mentioning, and I thought the messages were wonderful, and I think the just the experience was great. It was tough to leave. I thought I'd give you an update on where we're at with the sale of our house. I know many of you are concerned about that and been praying about it. We have had about 12 showings in the past 6 months, which is not a lot, but we have had five in the last week, all during the feast. So we're wondering if the activity is starting to pick up on it, and we're hoping that is the case, but we have no offers as yet, so we're still commuting back and forth. I decided yesterday, that I wouldn't come home, unload, and then head up there again. We have a couple of capable men up there to speak today, and I can always take care of the congregational needs by phone and by email in case anything happens. And actually, quite a few were not going to be back anyway. There were quite a few traveling overseas, and I think the numbers would be down. I think Duluth was actually canceling services for the day because no one was going to be there. And the Little Falls Church was going to be very small as well. I think they had a DVD going. So we're still in the process of commuting and are getting tired of that. So please continue your prayers. We would love to be able to sell our house. Every weekend I go up there, I'm excited and charged up, but every either Sunday or Monday I drive home. It's I have lots of questions. You know, I feel like we should be there, and we're not there yet. I know God's going to work all this out in His time. So I'm just trying to avoid being patient. But Mondays are tough. Mondays are tough. And it's nice to come home, nice to see the family, and it's nice to be in a familiar surrounding. But we got work to do up there, and we hope and pray God will enable us to get up there very soon. Well, I was looking, I wonder what I should speak on, and every time I've come here, I think the last time I spoke here was in May, late May, so it's been 5 months. And I know it's been longer than that, though, since we were into the Ten Commandments series. I think I couldn't remember which one I stopped on. And I look back at my records and found out in June of 2009 was my last one here, and that was number 6. And everyone's been complaining ever since that I stopped those. So I thought I would continue on today, and that would, and whenever we could get to the other ones in the future, we will. You know, as humanity travels further down the path away from God, our human nature, our corrupt thinking, has given us a knack for taking the things that He created to bless us with, and we turn them into curses. They're beautiful, wonderful, great design, and then our abuse of them turns them into a real problem for us. We've turned the joy of eating into gluttony. We've turned the cheer of alcohol into drunkenness. What we now call art, God would call an eyesore. What we would call music, He would consider noise. One of our most dreadful corruptions involves our sexual relationships. What God designed to be a beautiful expression of love between a husband and a wife in marriage, the sharing of affection intended to bring unity and stability for that couple and for their families or children, we've degraded into a selfish, vulgar, groping free-for-all that could now very well constitute the greatest single threat to the institution of family and the very existence of humanity itself. The effects of this self-made curse on human society are incalculable. First and foremost, sexually transmissible diseases, STDs. The amount of pain and discomfort, the infertility, even death that they have caused over the past few decades is almost incalculable. There were two types of STDs in the 1960s, just two. Now there are 25. And if you want to count virulent strains, there are 50. The CDC reports that 19 million new infections of STDs happen every year. Half of them between young people between 15 and 24. Estimates are that as many as one half are asymptomatic, so they go unreported. Many of those who have them don't even know they have them. till much later in life, a physical or trying to get pregnant or something, and they realize it. The STD or the CDC estimates that over $16 billion a year in healthcare costs are spent solely on STDs. There are other major problems as well. Last time I gave this message was about, I think, about 3-4 years ago, and I wanted to try to update some of the statistics on this. The sad thing is, and this is indicative of our society as well, you can't find statistics on these things. They're old, 2002, 1999, 2005. We just did a major census in 2010. And I realize that some of that data is probably still being worked on and put together. But there should be some updated information on this. And it's almost as though our political correctness within our society is making this kind of information unobtainable. And for those who even do accurate, valid studies and publish these things, they are accused by groups that have their own agendas. And they don't want any of this information getting out. I saw one entitled... the group was entitled Alternatives to Marriage. Alternatives to Marriage. Let me just read you a few statistics. This is from a series of reports taken from a group called the National Marriage Project. This is Rutgers, New Jersey State University. This group, the National Marriage Project, was founded in 1997. Their benchmark study was in 1999, and they've been updating as they go. Also, what's been updating as they produce their annual updates are the amount of individuals who are attacking them for producing this kind of information because no one wants to see it. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants their lifestyle exposed and criticized. Just a couple of quotes. Couples who once might have wed and then divorced are now not marrying at all according to the state of our unions. It's a study. The annual report, which analyzes census and other data, is issued by the National Marriage Project at New Jersey's Rutgers University. The U.S. divorce rate is 17.7 per 1,000 married women, down from 22.6 in 1980. Now, that sounds encouraging, that the divorce rate is actually down, until you dig into the statistics to tell you why. The marriage rate is also on a steady decline, which is causing the divorce rate to drop. 50% drop since 1970, the marriage rate, from 76.5% per 1,000 women to 39.9%, says the report, whose calculations are based on an internationally used measurement. Cohabiting couples have twice the breakup rate of married couples, the report says, and in the USA, 40% bring children into these often shaky live-in relationships. What's happening now is they're in this marital age group between 25 and 34. This is considered the prime time to be married, the prime ages to be married. The number of individuals who are not married in this group for the first time since they've been tracking this stat, I think it's been 40 years, the number of people not married in this group outnumber those who are married. The U.S. has the lowest percentage among Western nations of children who grow up in with both biological parents. The lowest percentage is the U.S. and Western nations. 63%, only 63% of our children in our society grow up with both biological parents. The proportion of U.S. adults between 25 and 34 who have never been married exceeded those who are married for the first time in more than a century, as I mentioned. The Census Bureau showed that for the first time, the proportion of people between the ages of 25 and 34 who have never been married exceeded those, and this is a stat from 2009, 46.3% have never been married in that age group versus 44.9%. The long-term slide in marriage rates has pushed the proportion of married adults of all ages to 52% in 2009, according to the Census Bureau, the lowest share in history. In 1960, 72.2% of adults over 18 were married. Let me just pick out a few other stats here. By 1997, the total number of unmarried couples in America topped 4 million unmarried couples cohabiting, up from less than half a million in 1960. It is estimated that a quarter of the unmarried women between ages of 25 and 39 are currently living with a partner, and about half have lived at some time with an unmarried partner. Over half of all first marriages are now preceded by cohabitation, compared to virtually none earlier in the century. There was a time when back in the 60s and early 70s when cohabitation was considered wrong. Now it's considered a must. Isn't that amazing how that can happen over a period of just a couple of generations? People actually think, most teens, the vast majority of teens in high schools today being interviewed, believe that they should be living together prior to marriage, that that will make their marriage more successful. It's not the case. Cohabiting is inherently much less stable than marriage, especially in view of the fact that it is easier to terminate. The breakup rate of cohabitors is far higher than for married partners. Within 2 years, about half of all cohabiting relationships end in either marriage or parting of the ways, and after 5 years, only about 10% of couples are still cohabiting. And again, that's data from the 1980s. It's hard to find updates for this because nobody wants to hear this. One of the greatest problems for children living in a cohabiting couple is the high risk that the couple will break up. Fully three-quarters of children born to cohabiting couples will see their parents split up before they reach the age of 16, whereas only about a third of children born to married parents face a similar fate. One reason is that marriage rates for cohabiting couples have been plummeting. In the last decade, the proportion of cohabiting mothers who go on to eventually marry the child's father declined from 57% to 44%. One study found that children currently living with a mother and her unmarried partner had significantly more behavior problems and lower academic performance than children from intact families. One study in Great Britain did look at the relationship between child abuse and the family structure, marital background of the parents, and so on, and the results were pretty disturbing. It was found that compared to children living with married biological parents, children living with cohabiting but unmarried biological parents are 20 times more likely to be subject to child abuse. And those living with a mother and cohabiting boyfriend who is not a father face an increased risk at 33 times the rate. In contrast, the rate of abuse is 14 times higher if the child simply lives with a biological mother who lives alone. Indeed, the evidence suggests that the most unsafe of all family environments for children is that in which the mother is living with someone other than the child's biological father. While the 1996 poverty rate for children living in a married couple household is about 6%, it was 31% for children living in cohabiting households. Poverty rate is much, much higher, much closer to the rate of 45% for children living in families headed by single mothers. The stats could just go on and on. I've got about 21 pages here of various statistics that I could spend all afternoon on. It's just incredibly sad. Americans are now less likely to marry than ever before in our society. Young people today want successful marriages, but they are increasingly anxious and pessimistic about their chances for achieving that goal. So they take these other steps to see if alternatives will work for them. Teens are more accepting of alternatives to marry, such as unwed parenthood and cohabitation. A dramatic decline in marriage rates have plummeted to a 40-year low. Let me just read you, this is from the 2000 U.S. Census. It's something I put together a number of years ago. Couldn't find updates on this. I'm hoping that as the 2010 census data becomes available, we'll be able to see this, if they're not hiding it. I really had to dig it out just in 2000. Fatherless homes account for 63% of youth suicides. Take all of the youth suicides, anyone under 18 who commits suicide, 63% of them came from a fatherless home. Fatherless homes account for 90% of runaway children, homeless children, 85% of children with behavior problems, 71% of high school dropouts, 85% of youths in prison, all from fatherless homes, and well over 50% of teen mothers. 50% of teen mothers grew up without a father. Again, the statistics are amazing. And again, they're getting increasingly hidden. It's much more difficult to understand this. Vanishing commitment to marriage and family. It's estimated that today half of all marriages end in the courts. But other studies show that 3/4 of all marriages end in the heart. People stay married, but they can't stand one another. They don't understand the relationship they have between one another. And as marriage rates plummet, children are growing up in more and more unstable homes, unstable lifestyles. They grow up angry and confused. You know, Malachi 3 and verse 16 says that divorce colors one's garments with violence. That divorce, increasing divorce rates lead to violent youth behavior. You will see that grow within our society and worldwide. We see that in Matthew 24, Christ was talking about the end time, describing the end time. And he said, as in the days of Noah, as people were eating and drinking and giving in marriage and getting married during that time, just before the rains fell and the earth was flooded, so will it be at the end of this age. It's the indication is that those would be the abuses, eating, drinking, and marriage. When family breaks down, everything breaks down. Malachi 4, we're told in Malachi 4 that if the hearts of the fathers aren't turned to the children and children to the fathers, then there would be utter destruction. There would be no need for God to carry forward with this version of humanity. This destroy it all. Why is that so incredibly important? Well, God designed the seventh commandment to prevent what we are heading into. And as it's been ignored, we have the society around us, and it's going to get worse. In Exodus 20, verse 14, he simply commands, "You shall not commit adultery." We are to preserve the marriage union undefiled. We are to keep sexual love as God intended it between a husband and wife. You say that in this society, and they think you're insane. You are insane. Wake up. What are you, naive? This is ridiculous. You know, nobody can have this kind of thinking today. Well, it wasn't that long ago that was the land. You know that cohabitation of about 40 years ago was illegal in most states in this country? Still is in some, but it's not even, those laws are not even exercised. They're not applied. Again, one can gauge how far our society has separated itself from God by how grossly we have ignored this command. Let's look through this command. Let's understand it better. I'd like to look at here definition and practice for the term adultery. We have to understand what that actually means. The American Heritage Dictionary defines it this way. Adultery is voluntary sexual intercourse between a married person and a partner other than the lawful spouse. It's a legal term. The etymological background of the word adultery doesn't originate from adult, which is what most people think. Adult has a completely different historic background. Adultery comes from the Latin word adulterare. Adulterare, that's spelled A-D-U-L-T-E-R-A-R-E, which means to alter or to corrupt. Adultery is a corruption of the marriage commitment, the marriage contract. Looking in Scripture here at what was intended with the word adultery, we have to separate it from the word fornication so that we can understand this, especially in the context of the Old Testament, looking within ancient Israel. In the Old Testament, since polygamy was practiced and divorce was allowed, it was important to understand the distinction between adultery and fornication, especially to be able to judge in such cases. And this is basically the approach that most of these commentaries have, and especially the Jews. From a judgment standpoint, if you're sitting in a court of law and you had to make a decision as to what somebody did, what law they actually violated after the fact, this is what you would have to understand. And it helps us to understand it as well. The Fawcett Bible Dictionary defines adultery as a married woman cohabiting with a man not her husband. It's always given from the perspective of the woman in the Old Testament. Again, because polygamy was practiced, men could marry more than one woman. Not that was God's standard, but he allowed men to do this. And divorce was allowed. So you have to define this from the perspective of the woman. Fawcett continues, "The prevalent polygamy in patriarchal times rendered it impossible to stigmatize as adultery the cohabitation of a married man with another besides his wife. Now, the word, the principal word used for fornication in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word zana, spelled Z-A-N-A-H, zana. Mounts writes this about it. Mounts says, to be or to become a prostitute. That's what the word fornication, translated from the word zana, meant. Zana means to become, to be or to become a prostitute, to be sexually immoral, to be promiscuous, to commit adultery, to be solicited for prostitution, to make a prostitute or to turn into prostitution. It's harlotry. Now, not all fornication is adultery. All adultery, though, is fornication. Let's look at that in the context of adultery. Again, fornication is not necessarily a violation of an existing marriage covenant. Adultery always is. The principal word for adultery, translated from the Hebrew, is the Hebrew word na'af. Na'af is spelled N-A-A-P-H. Jacinius defines it this way. To commit adultery, always a sexual violation of a marriage covenant. And this is considered much, much more heinous. Let's go to Leviticus 20 here. I'd like to read four scriptures fairly in rapid succession here so we have an understanding of this separation, the difference between adultery and fornication. Leviticus 20 and verse 10. The man who commits adultery with another man's wife, adultery is with another man's wife, a man with another man's wife, he's violating the covenant that she has with that other man. The man who commits adultery with another man's wife, he who commits adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. We're talking about a consensual relationship, adulterous relationship. It's about going into another man's wife. And again, it has had to do with that a man crossing those marital bounds, that commitment that that woman made to another man. Let's go to Proverbs 6 here. Proverbs chapter 6. And read verses 27 through 35. We'll be coming back here a little bit later as well to break this down a little bit more, but I want to read these in succession. I think it helps us understand. Proverbs 6, beginning reading in verse 27. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Again, going into his neighbor's wife is the principal issue here. Somebody else's marital commitment violated. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. Now, not only are we violating God's law here, but we're violating a trust relationship between a woman and a man who have already made a commitment to one another based on God's law. And ultimately, it's a commitment to God. Every one of us as individuals is a creation of God as individuals. When two wants to come together, God establishes the precedent by which that relationship is established and by which it's held together. And he says it's for life. It's for life. It's until death. He has designed it that way and for a reason. It's for the stability of society. It's so children can have a stable environment to grow up in. It's so that he can have godly offspring. That's the way children are taught when they recognize that stable relationship. Sex prior to marriage, sex outside of marriage, sex with someone else within marriage violates that covenant, violates that trust, destroys the family, destroys ultimately children and society. Verse 30. People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is starving. Yet when he is found, he must restore sevenfold. He may have to give up all the substance of his house. Whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. We'll come back to that later. Wounds and dishonor he will get, and his reproach will not be wiped away. For jealousy is a husband's fury. Therefore, he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will accept no recompense, nor will he be appeased, though you may give many gifts. There's no appeasement for this. There's no paying back for this violation. Once it's done, it's over. It's next to impossible to rebuild. going into another man's wife, there's no fixing another man's jealousy. And we'll see a little bit later as we go into some of these other examples how God uses this example of the lack of trust or the breaking of the trust that Israel had with him. Ezekiel 16 now, next. Ezekiel 16, we'll read verses 32 through 38. Ezekiel 16, verse 32. You are an adulterous wife, referring here to Israel. You are an adulterous wife who takes strangers instead of her husband. Men make payment to all harlots, but you made your payments to all your lovers and hired them to come to you from all around for your harlotry. A harlot would be somebody who's sleeping with all kinds of men for money's sake or for her own livelihood. In this case, Israel violated a trust commitment with God, specifically with God, and paid those she slept with outside of that relationship. Paid false gods and those deities and the heads of those false religions. Verse 34, you are the opposite of other women in your harlotry because no one solicited you to be a harlot, in that you gave payment, but no payment was given you. Therefore, you are the opposite. Now then, O harlot, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God, because of your filthiness was poured out and your nakedness uncovered in your harlotry with your lovers and with all your abominable idols and because of the blood of your children which you gave to them, surely therefore I will gather all your lovers with whom you took pleasure, all those you loved and all those you hated. I will gather them from all around against you and will uncover your nakedness to them that they may see your nakedness. And I will judge you as a woman who break wedlock or shed blood are judged. I will bring blood upon you in fury and in jealousy. Breaking wedlock. Breaking the commitment. Breaking the vow. Let's go to Hosea here. Hosea chapter 4. It's right after the book of Daniel. Hosea 4 verses 11 through 14. Hosea 4:11, harlotry, wine, and new wine enslave the heart. This can be as addicting as alcohol. Verse 12, my people who ask counsel from their wooden idols and their staff informs them, for the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray. The spirit of harlotry is something we must understand as we move into Christ's explanation of adultery and fornication in the New Testament, which we'll do shortly. There is a spirit of harlotry that we must understand in order to avoid it. And they have played the harlot against their God. They offer sacrifices on the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills under oaks, poplars, and terebinths because their shade is good. Therefore, your daughters commit harlotry and your brides commit adultery. You see the separation there? Daughters, unmarried, commit harlotry. Brides, those committed to a marriage relationship, whether anticipating in an engagement period, a betrothal period, or those who are actually married, they're committing adultery. And we must understand, again, this relationship, as our relationship with God is spiritual, we must understand how He designed the marriage relationship to work and how sex should work within that marriage relationship. Clearly, Israel violated all these things, and they were violated on a spiritual level that we must understand. There's a metaphor here we must understand. Verse 14, I will not punish your daughters when they commit harlotry, nor your brides when they commit adultery, for the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with a ritual harlot. Even though, even in the Old Testament, legally it was defined through the woman, the men are doing the same thing. In fact, the men are in most cases promoting it, propagating it. They were just as guilty. He wasn't going to punish the women only. The men were at fault. And offer sacrifices with a ritual harlot. Therefore, people who do not understand will be trampled. Something we must understand, especially this concept of the spirit of harlotry, prostitution, whoredom. It is the shameless selling of oneself for profit or for gain. And when one in a marriage covenant tires of their spouse, tires of their relationship, convinces themselves that their relationship is perhaps too restrictive. Most often that's because they see somebody else that they would like instead. Or it's too boring for them. You know, it's all the excitement is gone. And they begin shopping for fulfillment elsewhere. When they buy, the shopping is what must be avoided, that attitude, that feeling, that sentiment. When they buy, ignoring their initial commitment to God and to that other, to their spouse, they commit adultery. Harlotry is most, in terms of an opposite, the opposite of harlotry is fidelity. It's faithfulness. As opposed to adultery, the opposite of adultery is more loyalty. Loyalty. The Easton Bible Dictionary defines adultery as conjugal infidelity. It says, an adulterer was a man who had illicit intercourse with a married or a betrothed woman, and such woman was an adulteress. When it's consensual, it's adulteress. The Amtrak Bible Dictionary on adultery, and this is pretty extensive, they give some scriptural references. We'll go to a few of these, but I like the way they break this out. This is the Amtrak, Amtract, the Amtrak Bible Dictionary on adultery. Where polygamy was allowed, as among the ancient Jews, illicit intercourse between a married man and a married woman was neither married, who was neither married nor betrothed, constituted not adultery but fornication. By the law of Moses, both the man and the woman who had committed adultery were punished by death. That was, we saw that in Leviticus 20 and verse 10 when we were there earlier. Let's go to Deuteronomy 22 here. And they make reference to this section here, this section of scriptures. Deuteronomy 22. I'll read verses, at least at first we'll read 22 through 24. Deuteronomy 22, verse 22. If a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die. The man that lay with the woman and the woman, so shall you put away the evil from Israel. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city, and you shall stone them to death with stones, and the young woman because she did not cry out in the city, and the man because he was humbled, he humbled his neighbor's wife, so shall you put away the evil from among you. That phrase, crying out in the city, shows that she consented to the behavior versus somebody who would not be consenting to it. Now look further down here at fornication, verses 28 and 29. If a man finds a young woman who is a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has humbled her, and he shall not be permitted to divorce her all his days. A man shall not take his father's wife nor uncover his father's bed. You see the separation here between adultery and fornication. Fornication, in some cases, could be covered by a subsequent marriage of the parties. This is not talking about rape here. We're talking about consensual, not rape. Rape was always punishable by death. But adultery, apart from fornication, couldn't be healed. And we read a few of these verses, but let's read a few more. Jeremiah 3. God often compares himself to a husband that's jealous of his honor. He made a commitment. This goes far beyond simply sex. This has to do with a commitment between the couple. Jeremiah 3, we'll read verses 6 through 10. Jeremiah 3, verse 6. The Lord said to me also in the days of Josiah king, have you seen what this backsliding Israel has done? She has gone up on every high mountain and under every green tree and there played the harlot. Again, approaching, coaxing false gods, apart from the one she was committed to. And I said, after she had done these things to me, return to me. And she did not. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. Then I saw for all the causes for which the backsliding Israel had committed adultery, and I had put her away and given her a certificate of divorce, yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but went and played the harlot also. At some point in time in a relationship like this, if one of the individuals is consistently outside of the relationship, it's dangerous to stay in the relationship, not just from a standpoint of STDs, but also the effect on the children and the instability it causes in the household. At some point in time, the only answer is to separate. Verse 9, so it came to pass through her casual harlotry that she defiled the land and committed adultery with stones and trees. And yet for all this, her treacherous sister Judah has not turned to me with her whole heart, but in pretense, says the Lord. Even though Israel went into off the deep end wholeheartedly, Judah, at least in pretense, looked like they were trying to keep the laws and so on, but weren't doing it in their heart. They were not following their heart. And you can also write down here Ezekiel 23. Ezekiel 23, verses 1 through 4, and also verses 36 through 49. We won't need to go into it. I think the point is made. Consistently, the human sexual relationship is used as a metaphor for the relationship between God and his people. There's a very, very important point in that for all New Testament Christians. The right and expectation of every loving husband is that his wife should share herself this personally with no one else. And she expects the same of him. Let's go here to Isaiah chapter 1. And look at the process. There's a subtle statement here about how this process begins. How did Jerusalem become adulterous? And how would that work in a personal relationship between a husband and wife? Isaiah 1, verse 21. How the faithful city has become a harlot or become unfaithful. The shift between faith and unfaithful. Somebody who believes and trusted in the relationship, in God in that relationship, in the other individual, slips over time. Trust deteriorates first and foremost, and it begins that way. It was full of justice. The relationship has become unfair. And because of unfairness or injustice in the relationship, one seeks justice or fairness elsewhere. Now, that could be perceived or it could be real. Righteousness lodged in it. Again, past tense. Righteousness is lost. An understanding of God's design and purpose, his law, as applied within marriage. Once marriage roles break down, God designed the roles and responsibilities for the husband and roles and responsibilities for the wife. They're very clear. Once those roles and responsibilities break down, so does the sexual union. Righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. Hatred is the spirit of murder, according to Christ in Sermon on the Mount. Hatred starts welling up because of these things. Verse 22, your silver has become dross, your wine mixed with water. So the purity of their relationship starts breaking down early. Verse 23, your princes are rebellious. Rebelliousness comes in there. The authority structure within the family starts breaking down. Respect for one another, leading in love, all those things die. Your princes are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loves bribes, follows after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless, nor does the cause of the widow come before them. Eventually, all mercy and compassion and all love deteriorate. It's kind of the process of the way that works. Adultery is unfair. It's compromising. It's unrighteous. It's selfish. It's cheap and tawdry. Adultery is classless. It defiles the most important commitment one human being can make to another. God designed it to be so. Let me just summarize with this statement. Fornication is committed by someone unmarried. It only carried the death sentence when it involved the priesthood or when it violated a marriage covenant or in terms of rape. Adultery, though, is committed by someone married or betrothed to marry. It always carried the death penalty except when it occurred between the two betrothed to each other. The principal separation between fornication and adultery is the introduction of a marriage covenant proposed as in a betrothal period or consummated afterwards. Now, this makes it easier for somebody standing in a position of judgment, a judge or somebody serving in a court, to make a decision as to who violated what and how it actually happened. But it doesn't necessarily make it easy to avoid violating either of those. Christ simplified this for us and helped us to understand how we can actually avoid these things. Let's go to Matthew. Matthew chapter 19, we'll read verses 1 through 9. Matthew 19, we'll begin reading at verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished these sayings, that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Now, interesting that they were testing him on this. Was there some indication that it was unclear for them, or that potentially they were violating some deeper, more meaningful purpose for marriage? Verse 4, and he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason, a man, singular, shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, singular, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. Let not man separate. Now, this one flesh obviously isn't one flesh. My wife and I are still two individual physical human beings. But the oneness there is something else. It's something different. It's much more aligned with our understanding of God as one. One family. One in mindset. One in focus. One in purpose and direction. One in character. One in plan. Verse 7. They said to him, why then did Moses command you to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? So they were given, Moses was given a precedent by God. Okay, you know, like this, if it's so bad that it's becoming violent, so bad that children are being raised in these destructive households, so bad that the fabric of society is breaking down because they were dealing with unconverted people, God allowed this. Christ said, verse 8, he said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. For us to understand marriage, and specifically the sexual union within marriage, we must have soft hearts. We can't be hardened by this. It's not emphatic. It's not these hard, rigid rules. Marriage is certainly a legal union. But love supersedes it, overwhelms it. The law of marriage doesn't disappear in its love and care and compassion. All the laws and rules are still there. The roles and responsibilities are the same. But we don't beat each other over the head with those rules. Verse 8 again. He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. I know that people take verse 9 and twist and turn that every which way they can. But Christ said, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Now, sexual immorality within a marriage is grounds for divorce. That's a pretty big statement from the author of marriage and from what we understand marriage to represent. This one flesh privilege, a man and woman coming together in a sexual union, is authorized only to marriage. There's no polygamy indicated in these verses. One man, one woman. And there's no at-will divorce for any reason. All one flesh activity outside of marriage is sin. Fornication in the Greek, the principal word used for fornication in the Greek is porneia. We get our word pornography from it. P-O-R-N-E-I-A, porneia. And it means to indulge in any kind of sexual intercourse, can include sexual immorality, fornication, and or adultery. Adultery in the Greek is translated from the Greek word mocheia. It's spelled M-O-I-C-H-A-I-O. It's probably pronounced Mocheia, but I didn't want to spit on the front row. Mount says this about the word mocheia: to indulge in sexual intercourse in violation of a marriage covenant, always used when the seventh commandment is recited. Now, is this only the act? Is adultery committed only in the act, the actually physically crossing that line and actually engaging in the act of intercourse? No. Let's go to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5. Matthew 5, Read verses 27 through 30. And see how it ties back to the scripture that we read to describe the process, that Isaiah 1 scripture, to describe the process of what happens in a marriage and how it starts breaking down in the heart first. Matthew 5, verse 27. You have heard it said, or that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Interesting statement. He doesn't say a married woman. For looking at a woman at all to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Why? You don't know if that woman's married. You don't know what her commitment is, whether she's betrothed or not. You don't know that she's been divorced, in which case he said later on that if it was a divorced woman and you have this thought about her in your head, you've already committed adultery with her in her heart. This is about the will. We're having this discussion up in the Twin Cities about sin, and I want to develop this even more. Well, this idea that sin could be something that's inherent to our bodies, like it's physical sin. No such thing. I mean, sin is a choice. It's a matter of the will. We choose to sin. Now, certainly the flesh is prone to it with all of its desires that have to be controlled. But we choose to sin. And it's not a matter of the flesh. Satan was spirit. He sinned. A third of the angels were spirit. They sinned. It has nothing to do with the composition of our being. It has to do with the will. That's why those of us who are going to avoid adultery or any type of sin have to focus on the will, the desire. When the desire begins to conceive, we'll go there in a moment in the book of James. Once you've already lusted, you have lust as a definition is to desire something you're not supposed to have. You want something that's illegal for you to have. It's illicit. The want is the sin. Crosses that line, violates the seventh commandment. That's adulterous. Verse 29, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you than for one of your members to perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell or the grave. Verse 30, and if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Now we know he's not telling us to defile ourselves, to pluck out our eyes and to cut off our arms. He's saying that if you're in a situation that's causing you to do this, if you're working at a place or going to a school or hanging around with friends or watching something that moves you into this capacity, get rid of it, throw it out, push it aside. Because these things can be developed just by what we see, or the process of doing something. Put those things aside. Hand is a reference to work. Eye is a reference to what we're filling the mind with, what we're exposing ourselves to, whether in movies or the internet or whatever. Once that desire conceives, it seeks fulfillment. It seeks to be born. Christ's instruction here addresses motivations, making less relevant the legal separation between adultery and fornication, or even, definition for sexual immorality. The violation of the seventh commandment begins in the intent of the heart, and the guard against it must be in the mind. It must be in principle. Let's go to Ephesians 6 here. Ephesians chapter 6 and read verse 12. Let's back up to verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Where is God's power? It resides in his will. Have you ever wondered how Jesus Christ prevented himself from sinning from the moment he was conceived until his mind was mature enough and intelligent enough as he grew as a child? What happened in those early years, 1, 2, 3, 4 years old? What happened to Christ in the terrible twos? He never sinned. Why? His body was fully capable of it. His will would not allow him. It is not possible for God to sin because of his will. Again, not the composition of his being, but his will. That's where we have to address this. And we have to believe, brethren, that those called out and chosen, that God has given to us His Holy Spirit, for within Christ should be living. We have to believe with the power of God's will within us, we can overcome sin as well. That's our faith. Verse 11, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. This is where the temptation comes from. Satan always attacks us through our flesh. Flesh doesn't sin. We sin in the will. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. It's in the will that we have to fight this. Let's go to James. I said we'd go there earlier. James chapter 1. And read verses 14 and 15. And understand here, this is talking about the prompt of sin and how it begins. Look at this in the context of this specific violation of an adulterous thought, adulterous idea. James 1 verse 14, but each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Okay, so the desires are there. We all have them. They're part of the flesh. The desire itself is not wrong. God designed us with these desires. And largely it is the fulfillment of these desires within the law of God that creates such happiness and joy. When you're hungry, you eat. When you're thirsty, you drink. When you're tired, you sleep. Well, sex is no different. It's a desire and a drive of the body. But it must be done within the limits of God, within the limits of His law. Tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires. This concept or idea of drawn away means you're already on this path. You're moving in a certain direction. And now the flesh says, no, I want that. I want that over there. And it's not on the path you're on, the path of righteousness, following Christ and His Word. I want that. And the body starts to get drawn off. Now, when it is drawn away, we can be tempted by these desires on either side of the path. But when we're actually drawn away from, we take our mind, the first thing that happens is our eyes leave the target, what we're looking at, the goal, an objective. If your eye causes you to sin, cast it out. The eye moves, and you see it. You see something you want. Now the hand moves, and then the feet and the body and everything moves in that direction. If your arm causes you to sin, cut it off. Then that we should actually do that. I think we understand that. Now that desire has conceived, and I like the way this is stated in the next verse. Verse 15. Then when the desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. You have decided in the will to leave that path based upon what you saw or what your body wants. You have decided in your mind and heart that you're going there. You don't have to actually go there, but you decided that you will. You will. That's where sin conceives. And then when desire has conceived, like a child in a womb, once a woman is pregnant and that egg affixes to the womb, the next thing is birth. It's going to grow. It gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Once you've decided that you're going to do that, you're going to look at that, I'm going to watch this movie, I'm going to expose myself to this wrong temptation, now it begins. And it doesn't end until it's fulfilled, which ultimately here leads to death. This prompt, This following lust, an illegal desire to have something, entertaining an unlawful desire to possess, mentally delighting in a sexually moral relationship, Christ told us that's where the sin happens. It doesn't actually have to come about. You're going to go over and take something, you decided you're going to do them, by the time you get there, someone stops you, and you don't actually go through it, doesn't matter. You've still sinned. You've still made the decision. Now, what is the effect? I said we'd go back to Proverbs 6. Let's do that here. That is the prompt. What happens after we actually follow through? Well, the effects, as we were reading early in the introduction, and all those statistics, the effects are absolutely devastating. And in most cases, what desire does to us when we're when a desire is trying to conceive, it narrows down our field of vision. Because when we're walking on this path, we recognize, okay, we get it. We understand the plan, and we want to stay on this because we understand out there is bad. Well, what it does is it narrows your focus. Now you begin forgetting what's out in front, and you think, oh, for this one moment I can do this, for this one idea, for this one thing I'm going to pursue, I can grasp that for now. God will forgive me. He's merciful and kind. We make all these kinds of judgments. That's the process. That's the prompt. Now the effect. Proverbs 6 and verse 26. Well, let's go back a little further. Let's lean into this a little. Verse 20. My son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. And when you awake, they will speak with you. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life. To keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. Don't let this physical attraction take over. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Reduced to a crust of bread. Adultery, a sexual addiction, impoverishes the man. It takes away his wealth, and it reduces him to poverty in more ways than one. We used to say, coaches used to tell us in sports, prior to a big game, no women, no girls. We wondered why. The coaches would say, women weaken legs. And it's not just a physical thing. But if your mind is not focused and you're focused on the cheerleaders instead of the quarterback or the linebacker that wants to take your head off, you're going to be weakened by looking at the women. Your legs will be weakened. I know. I've been through that. Reduced to a crust of bread. How many of us have seen really strong, virile men being led around by the nose by a woman? I've seen it too many times in my life. I can never understand it. Toughest guys I've ever seen in my life. You know, could beat up 6-7 guys at once. Look at Samson. Look at the example of Samson. Hundreds, thousands of men could not take out Samson. Take out by one woman. Reduced to a crust of bread. Let's look at verse 32 here again. Whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul, his own life. This is a reference here of to the death penalty as a punishment for adultery, but it also talks about the effect of what happens afterwards. Lacking understanding or lacking heart, lacking focus, perspective, awareness, destitute of moral principle and prudence. We see what happens. The STDs, the divorce rate, the destruction of society over generations. We're seeing it now. It's all around us. But nobody wants to put a finger on it. Even those who are studying and researching it, they'll research 100 things, and the 99 that prove we should change this behavior, they throw out. They push aside, they lock in a vault, they burn or they shred. They pull out the one. I saw one stat that said, well, you know, a study in Germany actually indicated there's actually no difference between the divorce rate between those who cohabit prior to marriage and those who do not. Why do they? Whenever you see a stat like that, brethren, you should ask the question, why did they limit this to Germany? And why were they even studying this in the first place? Who was doing the study? Who supported it? Who funded it? An association for alternative lifestyles? Alternatives to marriage? Who is doing this? And what was the study like? How many did they actually interview? Was it a valid research? They just like taking these little stats and people glom onto them and use them. So does that mean Germany applies worldwide? It's just silly. I learned to do this over 19, 20 years in marketing research. It's one of the first things they teach you in your MBA classes when you're doing research. You know, put your feelings aside. Make sure that the research, the model for the research, the construction of it is accurate. And make sure when it's done, it's accurate. I can't tell you, though, how many times I brought accurate, valid research to my boss, but he threw it out because it wasn't what he wanted to hear. Go back and redo that. A number of iterations with small tweaks at the front end of it can prove anything you want to prove. You're going to see that more and more and more in society. We saw that Malcolm Murray gave an interesting presentation about how knowledge is exploding, increasing. Satan will not be allowed by God to stop the gospel message. But what God will allow is for Satan to put out as many counterfeits as he wants and to cloud your mind with so much knowledge, so much sifting work that has to go on, that on your own you would never be able to find it. God has to reveal it. We can cut through all this clutter with our strong gospel message as much as we want. Unless God is opening that mind, it won't be seen amongst the rest of the clutter. I just go on for that aside. Let's go to Proverbs 5 here. I'd like to read the entire proverb here. And understand, as we read through Proverbs 5, we can understand the toll for disrespecting God-given boundaries for marriage and the penalties that we face personally and as a society. Proverbs 5, verse 1. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding. That lend your ear means literally to bow. That means concede, not just yield, but submit to it, to God's understanding. Verse 2. That you may preserve discretion and keep, and your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey. Interesting how they go from this, your lips may keep knowledge, so that whatever you say, you're speaking the truth. And you're speaking with intelligence and wisdom. Right from that goes, for the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but in the end she's as bitter as wormwood. Looks enticing. Looks like it could be an opportunity. And don't think of this from the perspective of just one individual woman. This entire society that tries to pull us away from our relationship with God, because we all made an individual commitment with God, very much like a marriage commitment. We decided we wanted to become part of, by his invitation, the bride of Christ. And brethren, we are betrothed. We're part of that marriage covenant right now. And we can violate that spiritually. If we're enticed by the harlotry of this world, we violate our marriage contract with Jesus Christ. That's how important this is for us. But in the end, she's as bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword, cuts both ways. Her feet go down to death, her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life, her ways are unstable, you do not know them. It's men especially. Men like to see things on the surface. Men are more enticed by what they see. They're more provoked by what they see. Women have it a little bit more. They're a little bit more balanced in their brain. They usually can sift through this stuff and are a little bit more aware. Men sometimes only are focused on what they can see for the moment, and we have this tendency to narrow everything down to this tiny little focus, and that's all we see for the moment. Can't go there. We have to make sure that we're broadening our focus with the Word of God, and being aware so that we can see the end result of where this path would take us. Lest you ponder her path of life. Her ways are unstable. This unstable way is something that we would be adopting should we adopt a relationship with this woman. You do not know them. Therefore, hear me now, my children, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others. This is strength and vigor. Remember, we talked about this. Some of the strongest, most virile men in the history of the planet have been captivated by a woman and gave up their honor, their vigor, put aside their strength. Samson's a perfect example. And your years to the cruel one. Once we go down that path, we become enslaved to the god of this world, and we reap the repercussions. Verse 10, lest aliens be filled with your wealth, and your laborers go to the house of a foreigner. How does this happen? You go into an alien woman, alien meaning outside of your marriage covenant, and, or a foreigner, someone who's different, because it's more exciting than your marriage right now, for whatever reason. Now, that individual gets pregnant. Your wealth, portion of your wealth, your inheritance goes to that individual, goes to taking care of this woman and your offspring through that woman. And you mourn at last when your flesh and your body are consumed. Is this a reference to STDs? Because that's clearly what this lifestyle produces. And eventually, death, not just incredible suffering and infertility, but death. Verse 12, and say, how have I hated instruction and my heart despised correction? I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to those who instructed me. Versus those God calls and reveals who fall in love with the truth. This one hated the truth, hated correction and instruction. Verse 14, I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Love your wife. Pursue marriage, and not marriage from your perspective, but by God's design. Ultimately, marriage works because God's a part of it, and he's a part of it because his laws are being applied within it. The roles and responsibilities for both individuals are decided on by God, and both individuals decide individually that their relationship, their commitment is first with God, then with each other. Very similar to the relationship we share as brethren within the bride of Christ. We're not here because we love one another. We're here because we love God above all, and we share that above all. That is the format of our relationship. It's the same way within marriage. Verse 16, should your fountains be dispersed abroad or streams of water in the streets, let them only be your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, you look at a tiny little deer. If you went up to the deer park up there in the Dells, they are the cutest, most wonderful little things you'll ever see in your life, and you just want to hold them. They won't let you unless you've got some cracker or something. But even then, they're tough to hold. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. Be intoxicated with her. This is the joy of marriage that God designed. Why? Look elsewhere. It doesn't work elsewhere. It fails elsewhere. Verse 20, for why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced by the arms of a seductress? Because she's seducing for a different reason. She's using her wiles and her power as she sees it. She only has power if you give it to her. For her own interests, her own wealth, her own way of get. Verse 21, for the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. He shall die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he shall go astray. The toll for disrespecting God-given marital boundaries, as we can see physically, is just horrendous. Our society will be brought down by them. The eternal penalty, brethren, is much greater. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 6. 1 Corinthians 6. Begin reading in verse 9. 1 Corinthians 6, 9. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, and all three of those are idolaters, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites. Interesting that those are the first three that are mentioned. Nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners will inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you, but you were washed. You were sanctified. You were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus by the Spirit of our God. He goes on here to discuss sexual immorality. They could just read that right through to verse 20. You can read that another time. For sake of time, we won't go through those. Chapter 7 is incredibly interesting for all those who are considering marriage, or you're in a marriage, whatever state of life you're in, all relative to the idea of marriage and God's design for marriage. There's something there for everyone. I would encourage you to read that as well. The union, though, of the believer with Christ is utterly incompatible with the spirit of fornication, the spirit of adultery, the spirit of sexual immorality. For those in whom Christ dwells, this should be emphasized even more. It's unthinkable that we should be that corruptible when the incorruption has been put in us. Natural desires that attract us to members of the opposite sex must be exclusively channeled toward a loving marriage relationship. They must be. Otherwise, the temptation to engage in sexual immorality can easily overpower our lack of self-control. Let's go to Ephesians 5 here. This is where Paul outlines this incredible mystery and helps us to understand what our relationships, our marriage and our sexual relationships in the physical now should be mirroring. You see, for the called, the marriage covenant represents much more than an earthly union. It's symbolic of a heavenly union to come. We are members of the bride of Christ. We are all betrothed. Marriage among God's called out ones takes on a much deeper meaning. Ephesians 5, we'll begin reading in verse 22. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church, and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with a washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. Wives, emulate the bride of Christ. Husbands, emulate Christ. Those are incredibly challenging, but they define our relationship. That's why God designed them that way. You know how the God family works? Christ was completely submitted to his Father, subject to him in everything, completely and utterly respect him, gave his life by his instruction. How does God the Father lead? In absolute love, compassion, kindness, gentleness. And Christ taught us how to lead. Don't lord it over others. And what is he telling husbands to do here? Beat your wife over the head when she does something wrong? No. Love her. Wash her with the water of the word. Be as compassionate for her as Christ was toward the church. Give your life for her in love. That's what should be designing the marriages within the church. If God resides within our marriages within the church, there will be incredible stability within the society, the fabric of the church. God wants us to understand that our marriages now point to a larger, more glorious marriage to come. Let's continue reading. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh and of his bones. Doing this will not just give you a better marriage, understanding these roles and responsibilities and applying them, and preparing for them, those of you who are not yet married. Not only will they give you a better marriage in this age, but they will help you better understand the relationship between the bride of Christ and Christ himself. It will give us a better understanding of what it means to live within the family of God, into which the bride will be married when Christ returns and she's married to her bridegroom. Verse 31, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in so particular love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. That's the design for marriage. But it's collapsing in the society all around us. It should not in the church. Faithful commitment is an important attribute of the God family. pure and exclusive. Our sexual practices should be representative of the God family. The very reason the Creator gave sex to humanity was to type the intimate love and commitment that the God family shares in. Outside the loving spiritual commitment of marriage, sex is useless, and left unchecked, it is destructive. Brethren, today sexual activity is assumed as a right, an entitlement, regardless of marital status. The thought of restricting sex to marriage, as I said earlier, is considered naive, ignorant. It's considered primitive. It's considered absurd by the society. And the growing number of broken relationships, hearts in misery, rampant STDs, angry, unstable children, does nothing to subdue this selfish, ignorant, human perspective. Sex outside of marriage is the most glaring sign of man's separation from God and is the most obvious warning of our inevitable self-destruction. Called out ones, let's be sure our perspective on sex is not so corrupted. Let's strive to preserve the marriage union as a type of that great marriage to come between Christ and the church. Let's keep sexual love as God intended, but a beautiful expression of love and affection between a husband and a wife.